American politics right now is interesting. The economy is, though, too, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 13th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Not for the first time in the last week or 10 days or so, we begin this program with a sidelong glance at the politics of this economy, history, of course, being made today in the House. Our lane, though, is where we shall stay, with a couple of items to note: the part that businesses are playing right now, and then on to the economics of this economy. How about that? Item number one, Airbnb. The short-term rental company said today it is canceling all of its short-term rentals in Washington, D.C. during inauguration week. Refunds and reimbursements in full will be paid to hosts and travelers. The rationale there, hopefully self-explanatory. Item number two, corporate political donations. Boeing today joined Hallmark and Walmart, a bunch of Wall Street banks and some others, in suspending all political donations. The question, of course, is how long that lasts. On the topic of how long things are going to last, we turn now to the gains to be had from those $600 relief checks that started going out a couple of weeks ago, and when we might expect to start seeing them show up in this economy. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has been talking to some people about how they are spending or not spending that money.
When Austin Flannery in Greenville, South Carolina, got his $600 check, he decided to splurge. First on a barbecue dinner with his girlfriend.
Brisket, beans.
Potato salad, iced tea.
That meal was like $70.
Then on some clothes, like a $50 pair of pants. Then he saw a painting at a local store of some French actor from the 1800s who's all dressed up and smoking a pipe. Bought that too.
And then I went home and I was like, man, he needs to be tattooed on me. He looks so elegant. So I got a tattoo of him.
On his forearm. Another $400. When Flannery got the first check in the spring, he used it to pay off medical bills. But he had just lost his job at an insurance company. Since then, he's gotten a new job.
Luckily enough, I'm in a financial place right now where I could afford to have a little bit of fun. So I did.
One reason the government is sending out checks is so that people like Flannery will spend money. Another is economic relief. I heard from people today who used the money to pay for necessities like rent and heating oil. In San Diego, Catherine Olensky and her husband got $1,200.
Some of it went toward just bills, just trying to survive.
Specifically gas and electric. They saved the rest. Olensky's a hairstylist, and her salon is currently shut down.
Honestly, who knows what 2021 is going to look like for work for me. And we always just want to be more prepared than less.
A lot of people are using the money to set themselves up financially, like Hector M. Rico in Chicago.
Me and my fiance, we plan to buy a house soon. So definitely trying to pay off some debt to build the credit, get a better interest rate on a mortgage.
And he's using some of the money to buy raffle prizes for his students. He teaches phys ed at a pre-K through 8 public school.
I like to give out like little pedometers. I get them at like Target sometimes for $30, $20. Jump ropes at the dollar store.
One thing I heard over and over, a lot of people are giving a portion of their check away to neighbors, family members, and charities like food banks. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
In tomorrow's news of this economy today, President-elect Biden's expected to announce his plans for another round of COVID relief tomorrow. It's likely to include $2,000 checks to individuals, extended unemployment benefits, more money to cities and states. And some Democratic members of Congress are pushing for Biden to include baby bonds, $1,000 for every newborn child as a way to help close the racial wealth gap. Marketplace's Samantha Field has that one.
The idea is that every baby in the U.S. would get a savings account at birth that the federal government would add to every year. How much would depend on a family's income. Once kids turn 18, they could use it to pay for college, buy a house, or start a business. Derek Hamilton is an economics professor at the New School.
It will ensure that regardless of the family you're born into, regardless of your race or your gender, you have some asset foundation by which to accumulate asset security.
White families in the U.S. typically have 10 times more wealth than Black families, according to a study from the Brookings Institution. And William Elliott, a social work professor at the University of Michigan, says baby bonds would help close that gap.
We can't make racism go away easily. We can't make gender inequality go away easily, right? But we can provide people with resources, and it has tangible effects on people's lives.
Those effects are more than just financial, says Michael Sheradin. He directs the Center for Social Development at Washington University.
The kids will do better educationally. Their social development will be higher at an earlier age. The parents are more engaged with their children's future.
Programs like this already exist in some states, including Maine, Pennsylvania, and Nebraska. The federal proposal would cost roughly $60 billion a year. David Neuville at the nonprofit Prosperity Now says more stimulus and unemployment should be the government's first priorities.
But if we really want to transform the economy in the long run, I think an investment like this is absolutely necessary to really begin to close that divide.
And with Democrats about to be in control in Washington, Neuville says he thinks baby bonds stand a real chance of passing. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Little bit mixed on Wall Street today. Not a whole lot of enthusiasm either direction. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Netflix has a new strategy for 2021. It's kind of ambitious, even for a company known to throw money at its content problems. A new movie every single week. Some originals, some acquisitions, but either way, that's a lot of premieres. And with basic subscriptions starting at $9 a month, maybe it's a streaming stretch too far? Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has the details.
Streaming competition heated up intensely in the last month when this happened.
You've always had everything, while people like me have had nothing.
Wonder Woman 1984 debuted online, paving the way for every other Warner Brothers film to premiere on HBO Max this year. Marketing professor Arun Sharma at the University of Miami says,
the competition has become very intense, predominantly through what HBO Max is doing and the success of certain series such as The Mandalorian on Disney.
So Netflix is starting the year with a weapon of its own, or rather 52. It promises to premiere a new movie every week. Big name actors and directors, drama, action, comedy. Jason Squire, editor of the Movie Business Book, says he thinks it's a brilliant move.
Netflix is already a movie studio. Their budgets are often higher for theatrical than studios. They have the cash. They have the ability. They are a studio.
But where's all that cash coming from?
Netflix has a ton of debt right now.
Some industry insiders, like media analyst Tim Hanlon, wonder if Netflix's strategy is sustainable. The platform is rumored to be spending $19 billion on content this year.
The question is, can they keep spending at that rate? For now, the stock market and Wall Street doesn't seem to be too concerned about it, at least in the near term. We'll see in the long term.
Netflix did not respond to Marketplace's request for interview, but with people around the world still stuck at home and other platforms getting blockbuster deals, it seems Netflix can't afford not to up the ante. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Might I recommend, should you be in the need, for early economic news, the Marketplace Morning Report. Tomorrow, David Brancaccio and the gang. And if you missed this program on the air, podcast, people, podcast. They're in the middle of another lockdown over in the UK after a big surge in the virus, thanks to that new strain, one that we are increasingly seeing over here, too, by the way. And that makes doing business tricky, all the more so if your business is caring for others. So with a nod to the reality that childcare plays a huge part in deciding who can work during this pandemic and who cannot, our partners at the BBC sent us this for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Rupam Carroll, and I own a daycare in the UK, in Nottingham. On a daily basis, we look after up to 40 children aged from, I think her youngest was 5 months, up to 5 years. Last year, we had a lockdown in the UK, so I ended up closing altogether. Financially, it was just awful. This week, we've got a new lockdown, and actually, it feels a lot more manageable for me. We are allowed to stay open this time. Looking after the children during the pandemic it's uplifting, but also it feels rewarding because last year when the children weren't able to come to nursery, it stopped a lot of parents being able to work and things don't get done, doctors don't do their rounds. We're enabling all that kind of stuff. I am generally worried about my finances. I've had to juggle such a lot. I've reduced the numbers of staff I've got, and that was really painful because they're not just numbers. They are people who I work with on a daily basis. I know them. I know their families. So having to reduce staff numbers and make people redundant was really painful. It keeps me awake at night, but it's what I have to do. My job has shaped my thinking about money in that I don't need as much of it as I used to. I plough money back into the business because it feels fulfilling, and that's the way that we develop and grow. Having my business has made me want less, but at the same time, it's also made me feel less secure. The problem now is if I don't have money, then there are other people who are depending on me. So it's increased my worry and my responsibility in that way.
That was Rupam Carroll running a daycare over in Nottingham in the UK. You can tell us how your economy is doing. We'd love to hear your stories. You can tell them to us at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
And all the shops are in this corridor here.
Under the building and through the tunnels and into the workshops we go. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, 31,060 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 56 points, about 0.4%, 13,128. S&P 500 up 8 points, about 0.2%, 3,809 are there. Mario was talking about how people might spend their $600 checks. So a look at one basic household cost, huh? Food. According to the USDA, before the pandemic, back in 2019, that's the latest data we have, households in the lowest income brackets, that's an average after-tax income of about $12,200, they spent about $85 a week on average on food. Households in the highest income brackets, that's about $174,000 after tax. Spent nearly $270 a week. Bear in mind, those numbers do include restaurant spending and probably do look a little bit different now. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not only are they dealing with another lockdown now, but 4.5 years after they voted for it, after two prime ministers lost their jobs because of it, after can't tell you how many meetings and negotiations and analyses, the Brits are also living with Brexit. New Year's Eve ended a 47-year-long economic and political relationship. Predictions from opponents were of economic disaster. That said, there is a new UK-European Union free trade deal in place. So, how does Brexit look in the cold, harsh light of the new year? Marketplace's Stephen Beard checked back with some of the small businesses he has been talking to for the past couple of years.
This small company in the English Midlands, Sargentson's, makes lightweight aluminium components for the auto industry. Even though it sells 25% of its output to the EU, the boss, Mark Noonan, voted for Brexit. And he wasn't that concerned whether there was going to be a trade deal with the bloc or not.
There wasn't any stress. We really weren't that worried. It wasn't an issue. Corona crisis is much more of an issue than Brexit.
The secret of his insouciance is that he's making a highly specialised product.
Basically, every component's x-rayed to make sure there's no defects. Most of what we do is...
His components are in high demand, especially among fast-growing electric car manufacturers. His customers have to organise all the shipping, pick up the costs and do most of the paperwork. And Brexit, he says, has made him look for more customers well beyond Europe.
We picked up a contract in San Francisco. We've got another contract in Beijing. The market is really buoyant. So everything's looking really good.
Selling a less specialised product and more dependent on the EU, the boss of this London-based company was never enthusiastic about Brexit. Lars Andersen exports to families across the EU more than 40% of his products, personalised stick-on name tags for children's clothing and other belongings.
Hundreds of thousands of individual labels being sent out every day from this office.
He's relieved about the trade deal. At least there won't be any tariffs on his name tags. But now that the UK is outside the EU, his customers themselves would have to arrange to pay sales tax on his products.
It just becomes more complex, a little bit more scary for a customer.
To get around the problem, Andersen set up a subsidiary within the EU in Ireland to handle his European business. It's meant more hassle, more expense. And at the same time, he says, the pandemic has closed many schools across the continent, reducing demand for his name tags.
It's kind of a perfect storm. A lot of things happening at the same time, and lower sales in the next few months will just add to the fun.
He's philosophical about the Brexit upheaval. Not so Darren Price, who also was always against leaving the EU. He's very unhappy about the UK's new trading relationship with the country's largest export market, worth around $400 billion.
We were pretty annoyed that what we're left with is a very thin deal that is certainly worse for business and worse for the country than remaining in the EU.
Darren and his wife Deborah run a small clothing company called British Boxers. They depend on an intricate European supply chain, decorative trim from France, fabric from Portugal and Italy. The new deal, says Deborah, may not entail tariffs or quotas, but it's still a far cry from the seamless trade when the UK was in the EU.
There's a huge amount of paperwork that needs to be filled in. It's taking longer, it's more fussy, it's taking extra time. And then obviously that has a knock-on effect with cost as well.
Nobody can say for sure what the knock-on effect will be on UK business as a whole. Brexit supporters point to the flow of traffic at the port of Dover, the main conduit for trade with the EU, and they claim the new trading relationship is a success. But opponents say the traffic is more than 50% lighter than usual due to the pandemic. It may be several months before the true impact of Brexit is felt. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
After the violence last week at the Capitol, one of the admittedly secondary concerns was property damage to the building. Yes, we've all seen the pictures, but also to the priceless art and some of the historic furniture that is found throughout that building. Reports so far do suggest most of the art is fine, but we did get to thinking about the mostly unseen work that goes into maintaining the Capitol. 2 years ago, on the eve of a new Congress being sworn in, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams told the story.
It's the day after Christmas, and teams of movers are rolling through the halls of the Rayburn House office building, just next door to the Capitol. If you were to visit your member of Congress, there's a good chance you'd come here.
And just turn it now, sideways.
That's Mo Rivers, blueprints in hand, directing his crew as they maneuver couches, desks, and bookcases into the office of a new member. The carpet is pristine, the drapes have been cleaned, the smell of fresh paint still hangs in the air. These workers move fast.
We can come in, lay carpet, paint, and have it set up the next day, overnight.
There's no time to waste. It's going to take more than 275 moves to get the new Congress, committees and all, into place. A lot of what happens up here depends on what happens below, in the labyrinth of tunnels under Capitol Hill, where a couple hundred craftsmen keep thousands of pieces of congressional furniture and equipment in working order.
It's a good central location where we can get to things quickly and move things around quickly.
Tom Coyne is the chief logistics officer for the chief administrative officer of the House. There's a DC title for you. He's in charge of making sure every member of the House has a fully functioning office with a sense of history.
And all the shops are in this corridor here.
The shops he's talking about are the workshops, where master craftsmen, some who've been here for decades, build new furniture and restore hundreds of desks, cabinets, chairs, and coffee tables, some of which have been around since Teddy Roosevelt was in power.
The Capitol is a working museum, so there's a lot of historical furniture there that we upkeep, repair, duplicate, replicate.
Darren Dahlstrom manages the cabinetry workshop. Most of the furniture in member offices has been through here at some point. His team also makes one-of-a-kind pieces likely destined for museums themselves. Dahlstrom is particularly proud of an intricate 20-foot table he built when John Boehner was Speaker of the House.
Sapele is a type of wood used, and it's bordered with a short grain of English yew, and it's a very beautiful table. It resides in the Speaker's office in their conference room right now.
Then there's the ornately carved lectern House members use when they give speeches on the floor.
Yeah, all the carvings were done by a couple of gentlemen in here. And some of the metal work inside I've taken home and welded with my own welder at home. And everybody's had a little hand in it.
These craftsmen often put in 10, 12-hour days when there's a lot of turnover after an election. In the same corridor below Rayburn, I find Mike Dean at the sewing machine stitching drapes for Speaker Nancy Pelosi's new office. The old fabric.
It was more of a darker brown, and now it's going to a lighter oyster.
There's an iconic red leather tufted chair just a few feet away. There were once hundreds of these Turkish chairs in House offices. Half the leather on this one has been removed, revealing the coils and stuffing.
It's going to have new leather. That's going to be the only difference in the way than that it was bought in the 1900s. I'm still going to have the coil springs, the horsehair, the hand stitching.
Wait, horsehair?
We do have a stash of horsehair. We reuse it out of all the old furniture.
Old as in the 1800s and 1900s, before foam took over.
We have a hair picking machine. I can show it to you if you want to see it.
Yeah, I do. Dean takes me across the hall past rolls of carpet and giant cutting tables to one of the last fully functioning horsehair picking machines in the world. Dean feeds in a clump of stuffing, and the machine quickly spits out a cloud of teased out horsehair.
It takes it all matted down and just fluffs it up.
So it can be stuffed back into a chair that will go back into a House office, where Dean hopes it will stay for at least 35 years before making its way back down here. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, of use perhaps should you be in the market for a new place of employment. Glassdoor, the site that lets people post their reviews of their companies, salary lists as well, that kind of stuff. It is out with its annual list of the best places to work. Some of the usual suspects, Google, Microsoft, LinkedIn is there, as are Delta Airlines and Lululemon and Facebook. Ranked above all of them, though, in the number three spot of the best places to work in this entire economy, In-N-Out, which for those of you unfortunate enough not to live near one, is a burger chain. It's a really good one, arguably the best, don't at me, but it's a burger chain. All right, we got to go, but here's your midweek moment of economic context. Kind of lost in the shuffle today. News of inflation in this economy still basically isn't any. The Consumer Price Index came out this morning, up 1.4% from December 2019 to last month. So bupkis on consumer inflation. In the fine print, though, this, which even if you're not driving right now as much as you used to, you are probably feeling or seeing at the pump. Gasoline prices jumped almost 8.5% from November to December. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They, once again, are the people coming into the studios so the rest of us don't have to, unless your home internet is terrible, like I've said. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.